Welcome to Polycast, the Civilization podcast focused on game strategy. Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
Ed Jin.
With guest co-hosts.
Ixias.
Morning, YouTube.
My favorite quote of all the interviews I've come across with Beyond Earth the last couple of weeks. Imagine a world run by the unholy alliance of Twitter and Wikipedia.
Oh my gosh.
That's unholy.
Welcome to episode 198. We have today Phil, or me and team.
Can my civ's hand hold your civ's hand?
We have Michael, otherwise known as Ixias.
Woo, you pronounced it, I think. I have no idea.
Mackie.
This episode of Polycast brought to you by the letters, it is too freaking early and there is not enough caffeine.
And we have Dan.
These are the games of the players of One More Turnus.
And last but not least, myself, warning you too, otherwise known as Steve. Michael.
Yes.
In your avatar, there's a picture of you looking, I'm assuming it's you, looking over to the right, and there's a woman who looks like she's scared to death. What did you do to her?
We decided to take a random selfie, and that was the face that she decided to make.
It's perfect. I love it. You're like, you're putting your hand someplace you're not supposed to be.
No.
No, okay.
No.
I'm just used to that look, putting my hand in places I'm not supposed to be.
I probably should figure out the actual pronunciation of my name.
Warning you too.
Well, it's a play on my name, Warning, as in Warner. I wanted to have Warning You when I first started playing Civ back 20 years ago, and that was already taken, so I took Warning You too, because U2 was one of my favorite groups.
Huh, fair enough. Michael, we all want to hear you try to pronounce your username now.
Ixias?
Say that again.
Ixias.
Ixias. Sounds like some kind of skin condition. Ixias.
You sound like an ancient Greek philosopher that we just discovered existed.
It's some type of butterfly.
Oh, you just randomly smashed keys on your keyboard, didn't you?
I was actually playing Words with Friends and was cheating, and that was the word that they told me to play.
You were cheating, so you were AI?
Yeah.
You don't get much warning with earthquakes. You don't get much with tornadoes either, but you get some.
I guess. I would choose to not have any of them happen.
Yeah, true, but where do you go in the world for that? There is nowhere in the world that you can go, but maybe if you go beyond Earth. Hey, the halfway decent
nice segue.
Let's go.
I'm impressed.
You know, lightning does strike at least once, just like a half-decent segue. So it's Civilization Beyond Earth, the Firaxis Games Mega Panel, Info and Analysis.
We represent a team at Firaxis that has been quietly working on something very, very special.
Sid Meier's Civilization Beyond Earth, the latest entry in the Civilization franchise. We'd like to take this opportunity to introduce ourselves on the panel here.
This is David McDonough, and I'm Will Miller. David and I are the lead designers on the project. This is Lena Brink, who herds cats all day. She's our producer. And Anton Stringer, who is our lead systems designer and gameplay designer. We could not make this game without him.
And on our last episode, when we were recording, the mega panel was actually ongoing. Now we're going to be able to give this upcoming Civilization title a proper treatment, and if you are wondering if this sounds like an Alpha Centauri spiritual successor, you would be correct. Says Will Miller, the heart of Alpha Centauri lives at Firaxis.
That's deep.
That's deep.
Well, I'm glad somebody there still loves it and wanted to give it a sequel, even if they couldn't call it that.
It is set to be released not only for Windows and not only for Mac, but also Linux. In fall 2014.
Woo-hoo.
It'll make my life a little more convenient.
The game picks up about 250 years from right now. It took modern day when we were sort of building the fiction for the product and went from there.
A la Civilization IV quest system.
Civilization has always been one of the best games for generative story, for procedural narrative. When you look on the fan forums or talk to Civ players, they always tell you the stories of their games. We see that at Firaxis every day, and we love that. And we want to build systems in our games that really underscore this wonderful property of our products. And the quest system is one of those things. It's sort of non-deterministic, depending on the game state, but they're kind of random. So different ones will show up at different times in different playthroughs, give different rewards. So you can't really game them as much as you might another mechanic in Civilization. I think the best analogy is the way that Magic the Gathering does it. Every Magic card has this little blurb at the bottom that kind of gives you this little window into what's going on. We sort of took the same approach with our fiction, how we deliver the fiction. The mechanical purpose of this system is to pull you through the new systems in the game, to provide you with these things to do, these goals to do that could give you an edge over your competitors, and to tell the story of the world.
It's kind of still up to you to fill in some of the blanks. Like, they might tell you a where and a when, but you don't know the why and how. And I think that's appropriate for a Civ-style game, a sandbox-style game, really, where it's not predetermined where the story is going to go, just like it's not predetermined how it is that you're going to get there, but depending upon your actions, certain victory conditions will not be open to you, and just like how you cooperate or don't cooperate with other humans, because there is combat, potential combat with other humans on the planet, and that actually came up as, we shouldn't be able to fight other humans on the planet.
Look, we're humans. If we're next to each other and we have conflicting ideas, we're going to start beating each other with sticks.
In about 25 years, there's this thing called the Great Mistake. No one really knows what the Great Mistake was.
That was the start of Polycast. Sorry about that. Praxis doesn't want to admit it, but...
Somehow we wind up destroying the world. I'm kind of proud of that, actually.
Regardless of what it was, though, it caused a humanitarian crisis the likes of which the world has never known. There was a massive migration of people. There were ecological disasters. The nations of the world were strained to the point of breaking. And there was a Dark Age over a period of about 200 or so years. The game picks up right as mankind has hauled itself out of this period, and the nations are back on their feet again. They have decided, given the state of Earth, to leave, to find a new home elsewhere.
That is already generating a lot of interest, and I think that's very Alpha Centauri-y in the sense that there is a story behind before you ever get to that point. And no doubt there'll be people that'll be like, oh, so are you going to play this civilization accurately, quote-unquote, based on what you think the Great Mistake is? People are already getting immersed in the story. You are going to be the first human colony as the player. And it is the only human colony, and the next human player is not to arrive until much later. And you will get notification in the game, according to McDonough on PC Gamer, and this information all comes from GameSpot. And you'll zoom over to see the ship from your opponent land. You'll get first diplomatic contact with them, and you're quote-unquote free to go from there. Got about 40 to 50 turns before that happens. So you get first crack at what it is that you want to do, and you get a little bit of a head start.
So finally, for once, I get to explore most of the ruins on the map before the AI takes them all?
Well, we don't know if there are going to be ruins
per
se.
There's some screenshot. I mean, it was a placeholder, and it was still Civ 5 art, but they had something like that on the map. There are alien ones.
Well, there's something about the orbital layer, its strategic offensive, defensive, and support capabilities. You can launch satellites, but after a while, they will degrade over time, and they'll eventually crash on the planet below, sometimes leaving behind recoverable salvage.
That's better than Alpha Centauri's infinite satellites that stay up for an infinite amount of time that give you infinite amounts of food and everything. That was a little OP.
Who does humanity grow up to be at the end of the story, and what does it even mean to win that game? There's no arrival point. In my mind, the game starts with this big turning point in the history of human affairs. So you play from that point until the next great turning point in human history, and you sort of decide what that is. Whoever wins the game is the one who has effectively decided what the next era of humanity is. But also they decide what it even means to be human at that point. And I think that's really well represented in the technology system.
I think the big item would have to be the technology tree, and it being non-linear, but rather it's not being described as a tree, but rather described as a web.
You start in the middle, surrounded by technologies that are relatively recognizable, and you grow out into any of the technological frontiers, and the web represents all of them. The web interlinks, you can move laterally, you can sort of explore, kind of find technologies that fit the situation that you're in, get the technologies that match what your goals are. And by the end of the game, you have maybe 70% of the text. They effectively represent the story of who you are.
And yes, to that end, there are not just three victory conditions, but there are five victory conditions. Three of them are tied specifically to the technological affinities, purity, supremacy, and harmony.
And there's two other ways. There's kill everybody. That's always an option.
It's a simp game.
Right. And then the last one, which we enjoy a lot, is called contact. It essentially means that you become the first human beings who act as an ambassador to another sentient alien race. They don't live on the planet. You find evidence of them. Eventually, you can sort of find out where they are based on bits and pieces you can piece together from the planet that you land on. Make first contact. Anybody from any affinity can win that. The diplomatic victory, in a way.
Apparently, there's no time victory. I don't know. I think we really need to rage about this and start many, many threads about how this is a front to the tradition of Civ. Yeah, I know I can't keep this going.
Because so many people care about that.
Absolutely. It's just like abstain. I mean, abstain is in pretty well every vote that you can possibly think of. If it was missing, we would also have to rage, right?
It made such a big difference when it was there, too. And so it totally counted differently than now.
Purity players would achieve a promised land victory by building a warp gate to bring humans from Earth to settle the new land. And you know they didn't call it Stargate for a particular reason. Copyright, I'm sure. Supremacy players will achieve their emancipation goal by building that same warp gate. And of course, now I'm thinking about Civilization IV. Instead of bringing humans, though, forces will return to Earth to free humans from their fleshy mortality.
If I wasn't a fleshy mortal, it would be easier to get up in the mornings.
Harmony players will be focused on the new planet, and that's planet with a lowercase p, not a capital P. We don't want people to be confusing this with Alpha Centauri too much.
As you navigate through this tech web, you start to accumulate levels in one of three, or all of the three technology affinities.
Harmony represents you examining the new ecosystem that you're on and figuring out not how you can like survive on it as a human, but really how you change the very genes and DNA and the organism of a human to be indigenous to this world. You invest heavily in becoming a thing that belongs on this world, that lives in symbiosis with its ecosystem. And you gain a lot of synergy with the alien life, with the alien flora and fauna, to the point where you eventually can use the alien creatures in your armies or breed entirely new creations based on their genes.
Their territory is large. They grow very easily. They have a lot of free movement over the terrain. They're very fluid, and they're very nimble, quote-unquote. And I'm thinking, oh, okay, the Shoshone.
Supremacy is very much the opposite. It says humanity managed to get off their planet. They survived because of their technology, because of the tools that we're able to build, and the machines. The machines were what saved us. So we're going to double down on that idea, even to the point of perhaps replacing all or part of our organic existence with a machine existence. The idea being that if we can live in this sort of pure, resilient machine state, we can survive anything. Any future cataclysm we'll be able to handle.
Start to leave behind organic ties, including up to a point their own bodies eventually.
Oh my.
Mm-hmm.
And then purity is probably the most sort of idiosyncratic. They represent a rejection of both ideas and the belief that wherever humanity goes in the universe, it is their duty, their calling to remain essentially human. If we lose who we were, then we lose who we are. And so they don't try to change themselves to fit the planet. They don't try to make themselves into robots. They try to keep themselves purely human. And they, in fact, invest in stripping out a lot of the flaws that are in the human genome and making it an ideal human. And then at the same time, making the planet into a new Earth, making the environment that they live in ideal for humanity, not the other way around.
They try to avoid conflict with alien life forms by building massive defenses, by being tough and very hard to kill, quote unquote. So I'm thinking, oh, okay, so they're more about the culture, not the tourism.
These virtues, these are something you pick when you create the game, like when you're setting up the game, or depends on civilization you pick, whatever group of like a colonist you pick. How do you get the virtue?
It's not to be based on the civilization you pick. It's tied to the technology web.
Oh, okay, I get it. Okay, I missed that part.
Yeah, you start going for cyborgs, you're pushing more towards supremacy, perhaps.
I would say it's somewhere in between an ideology and a religion or a philosophy, an attitude about what humanity ought to be in the future, but also how humanity is going to deal with the challenges of their new existence, the fact that they left Earth and they're on a planet that they did not evolve to live on.
I like how it's kind of like the ideologies of you still have your core thing that you're going for. They push you towards it even further. Well, sort of. They're kind of all intertwined.
So you don't actually play as a leader of a civ at this point. You're not the chief colonist. You just get directed depending on what technologies you pick. Well, I can see how it's radically different from Civilization.
And I know one of the criticisms, even in Civilization 4, but also in Civilization 5, is the technology bottleneck. I want to be able to go over here, but you're telling me I have to go over there first, even though over there is not what I want, and this is to bypass that. To me, it's kind of like the difference between going on vacation and having a tour guide or just exploring on your own. Civilization is the guided tour, whereas Beyond Earth is like where you're your own guide.
Let's just hope that each of the web options are at least reasonably close to viable against the others.
Oh, that would be terrifically fun to have Purity super overpowered and then you have nobody picking Supremacy.
Yeah. Hey, guys, I think we should open Tradition.
When I hear that there is a victory condition tied to each type of technological affinity,
that helps.
Plus the other two kinds, I think that also speaks to what we saw a little more with Brave New World as compared to Gods and Kings, or certainly Vanilla Civ 5, which was, you're going along the game, let's say you choose Harmony, and there's the Supremacy person next door that's going to go squish, and you can be like, oh, good luck with that Harmony victory. Maybe I should try to push my, say, my technological advantage and make contact with this other advanced life forms, these aliens, and win that victory that way. So I think that's kind of tied to both of those things. Speaking of comparison to Alpha Centauri, unit customization. Unlock different upgrades through the tech web and customize your units to reflect your playstyle. And inevitably people are like, Unit Workshop?
Unit Workshop? The unit upgrade systems have unit customization in Beyond Earth. And depending which affinity you pick, you get different upgrades available to you at certain affinity levels. First and second level, which are still shared. Humanity hasn't developed far enough into any affinity to make it distinguishable visually. But at the third step, it starts to branch out.
Purity has a certain sort of tactical flavor to it. So when you have a Purity army in the field, it behaves a certain way and its upgrades kind of have a certain profile. Basically about raw strength and about hovering above the ground and not having to worry about the terrain and just bringing as much firepower as you can. Harmony is about using the land around you and healing and using kind of hostile alien life forms and hostile terrain to your advantage. And Supremacy is about sort of tactical geometry and kind of organizing your units to support each other and getting a lot of bonuses for that.
There are alien creatures that, depending upon how you behave towards them and including which technological affinity you go for, will have influence on what you're able to do in the game, including a possible victory condition that you could go towards.
There is an alien world that developed, and there's life on that world. It might not be intelligent life, but it'll play a big role in the game.
Aaron 90495 asks in the chat, have they confirmed, I'm assuming that either developer for Axis Games or publisher 2K, have they confirmed that the military victory works like domination in Civilization 5, being you capture all of the capitals of your opposing civilizations, not every city? Traditional military conquest, achieved by wiping out all opposing civilizations. So based on that wording, now that comes from Game Informer, so I would say no. Based on that, it is not like your domination victory in Civilization 5.
It's kill everything.
Unless it just happens to be coincidentally that that civilization you're taking out only has one city, which is also its capital, but that would just be a coincidence.
Is this game Civilization in Space? Is that it? Is it just a skin of space onto Civilization?
No.
It's definitely...
So there's new stuff.
There's a lot of new stuff. You're going to feel right at home if you're a Civ 5 player. You'll know what a city is and what tiles are and what yields are and things like that. But beyond that, treat it like Civ 5 at your peril.
Will Miller, again co-lead designer, in an interview on PC Gamer, says, one of the systems we're really excited about is the White Hat, Black Hat Covert Ops. It takes espionage from Brave New World and expands it quite a bit. And right away I'm thinking, what is one of the leading ongoing criticisms of Civilization V in terms of mechanisms that should be, could be, would be played with to get better? How come we can't do more in espionage? It sounds like we're going to get that, only now we're getting that in Beyond Earth as opposed to Civ V. Miller says you can do many, many more things with spies when you get them in cities, like smuggling from them, stealing their research and technology, things like planting the Dune Thumper device in their city and having worms pop out.
I may use that a little too much, I can tell you right now.
And if you want that option, then I guess Mackie is going to be going Harmony, Harmony, Harmony as her technological affinity, because only they can do that.
You know, I've been looking at some of these screenshots, and these creatures or whatever look terrifying. Like, I don't know if I would leave my
little bubble. Oh, yeah, the alien units just got there, the little bugs and things. It's like, do I really want this for my buddies? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
To quote an episode of Star Trek The Next Generation, these aliens probably think that we are ugly bags of mostly water. So they probably think we're terrifying, too.
They're all fleshy and meaty. How do they live?
Sid Meier, interviewed on GameSpot, says, when I talk to fans at conventions, they always ask for pirates, railroads, and Alpha Centauri. They're already getting Civilization, and that was probably at the top of their list. We've got a lot of new ideas, have learned a lot, and there's so much new stuff we can do in a science fiction setting.
This game tells the story of your expedition, the one that you decide to take to a new world.
You start with this idea of the expedition leaving Earth. So you choose what nation sponsor is going to be kind of funding your expedition. One of our sponsors is the Pan-Asian Cooperative, and that carries with it a certain set of gameplay bonuses.
By the way, there are 8. It is possible that, for example, the leader, according to Anton Stranger, in one game she might go for purification, but in another game she might go in a harmony direction, and she'll play like a totally different civilization.
Cool. That seems interesting.
But you also pick what type of spacecraft you want to leave on, and what you want to put in the cargo hold, and the type of colonists that you want to bring with you. So the choices that you make, even in the game setup before you start on turn zero, influence the type of game that you're going to have, and it tells a different story every time.
One of the neat things we got to do as designers is sort of reinvent what Earth looks like after the Great Mistake, and the sponsors that you see are the best and brightest from those nations. So part of the cool fiction of the game is figuring out where they came from and what their backgrounds are.
It's not about humans versus aliens. It's about different factions of humans all trying to go to that next place.
There's been no discussions about multiplayer, right, Dan, as of yet?
All we do know is that up to 8 players can, quote-unquote, compete for dominance of a new alien world, according to the official website. Then nothing else said about multiplayer at this point in time.
We can assume maybe, since it looks as if they took the base engine under Civ 5 to do it, even though the graphics and everything are changed. The problem is we're still early. We don't know enough stuff about different systems to really talk about them yet. I mean, like, we know that the social policies are called virtues, and yeah, that's about it.
Here this is, and that's all we know from it.
It looks very graphic, like high graphics. Have there been any talk about the requirements for this game? Like,
oh, system requirements? No.
No?
Fair to say you're going to need at least what you need as required, if not recommended, system specs for Civ 5, seeing as it's based off the Civ 5 engine. But beyond that, it's...
We don't know.
Where I work, I happen to show a couple of people the announcement, the PAX announcement. And the people that have never played Civ before, never seen anything regarding Civilization, went, wow, that game sounds pretty cool. And it seems to be resonating with people. 45-year-old men that are looking at a screen on my phone and they're going, wow, this sounds neat. Got me excited. People are interested to see what BE is going to be.
It'll be interesting to see how many people who are actively playing Civilization now, whether it's Civilization 4 or Civilization 5 or even earlier Civ titles or a combination thereof, pick up Beyond Earth. And if they pick up Beyond Earth, if they stick with it, and whether or not they're playing like Beyond Earth, but and they still have Civilization 5 installed, I'm already in my mind getting comparison discussions to when Civilization 5 came out, which is nearing 4 years ago now, by the way.
That long? Wow. Wow.
It's 2010. About how you could have Civilization 4 and Civilization 5 installed on your computer and enjoy them equally because it really wasn't a replacement for the previous title. And I think Beyond Earth even fits that mold even more. I think that if you're a Civilization 5 player, you're going to feel at home right away with the user interface, and probably the learning curve is going to be a little less as compared to someone who maybe last played Civilization 4 or an earlier Civ title. But it's interesting what you say there, Steve. I've actually been hesitant to mention to any family or friends about the next Civilization title because as soon as I say the word Civilization, the eyes roll in the back of their head.
Yeah.
But it'd be interesting to see how many new players to the Civ series we actually pick up, because quite honestly, I've seen some negative reactions to Beyond Earth, not just because it's not Civ 6, but because, oh, no, this shouldn't have Civilization in front of it. This is not Civ. This is set in the future. This is fantasy. This is fiction. And I'm thinking, well, I guess it comes down to how...
How about when they're famous for designing strategy games, they can decide how to market them?
If it's not for you, then fair enough. Or if you try it and you don't like it, I'm hopeful there'll be a demo that people could download and then decide whether they want to pick it up or not. Then that's certainly fine. But I think we're getting caught a little bit on the semantics of the fact that it's got Civilization in the title, and some people just kind of say no right away. But I honestly think they are going to be the minority, because I think the infusion of excitement from those who are remembering Alpha Centauri, or I wouldn't even be surprised if there are people who have, in the last couple of weeks, played Alpha Centauri again, or maybe even picked it up and started to play it and realized if this is what Alpha Centauri is, imagine what Beyond Earth can now be 15 years later.
Yep.
That's right. It was 15 years ago Alpha Centauri was released, along with its one expansion pack, Alien Crossfire.
I've actually never played Alpha Centauri, and I'm extremely excited for this game. I think it's pretty cool that they're taking a completely different approach to Civilization. I've never played a Civ game before Civ 5, and I actually went back and started playing a little bit of Civ 4, but I think it's cool that they're taking it in a different direction, but still keeping the heart of the series in it.
I think people that are into modding, I mean, there's going to be a lot of options to invent whole new, you know, worlds and units and that kind of stuff that people haven't had before, so I'm sure modders are getting excited about it.
Oh, and that makes me think of another criticism I've seen of Beyond Earth. What? It's only one planet? And it's like, really?
Civilization's taking place on one planet.
Well, what are the odds of having two planets that are habitable that close? I mean, in real life, the closest planet is like several thousand light years away, so...
Yeah, the actual universe in the galaxy is not exactly littered with habitable planets, or at least human habitable planets.
No.
Well, we don't really know how many there are.
Well, in our cataloging so far, it is not as common as we would like to think.
Well, you also define habitable.
I think when you talk about games and player imagination, particularly as Civ players and strategy players, we like that. We don't want to be told absolutely everything. We want some things left to be up to our own imagination, our own creativity, and I think that's very appealing.
Part of the Civ franchise. Like, you know, you're playing as ex-Civ. They didn't have an immortal leader in real life, and there are differences, so I think that's kind of a cool thing.
Even in the original Alpha Centauri, there were quotes that went along with some of the technologies that were the leaders and the factions in the game that gave you a little bit of a story of maybe how it went if you hadn't been there to be one of them and interfere with it. But you can make up your whole own narrative, and depending on who your neighbors were, it was an entirely different story each time. I mean, if you played the university every time, you had different neighbors, so it went differently. So we'd like these little hints to give us a framework. I want to liken it to, with Mass Effect, you can choose some of the background of your Shepard, but they still have a similar story, but you get more involved because you got to choose.
Yeah, I think the involvement is something that is going to be really cool with this. Pick a civilization, but it sounds like you can kind of mold that into whatever you want and kind of go from there.
Oh, this sounds incredibly awesome. I'm geeking out like crazy.
So the price for Beyond Earth I saw was like going to be $50, $49.99 or something?
It's not an expansion. It is a standalone.
Yeah. But I thought $49 was kind of pricey compared to a previous Civilization game, well, like games. But
no, it's comparable.
That's comparable, yeah.
That's how much Civ 5 was.
Yeah. You're just thinking because we've gotten all the expansions for around 20 or 30, now that it's a full game,
Okay.
Yeah, because we've had an expansion a year for 2012 and 2013, and then people are also thinking about what they pay for downloadable content, because I've seen that. Some people are like, this is DLC for Civ 5.
This is all going to be for Steam.
Like, what?
It's all going to be offered through Steam?
I'm pretty certain. I think we can
assume that unless they say otherwise.
No, it's going to be offered through GameSpy. I'm sorry.
It's a post by 2K David, and essentially this article reads, 2K's online server migration from GameSpy technology. Just straight up a nice gesture by them. They are offering some legacy support for some of their games, specifically Borderlands, Civ 3 and its expansions, and Civ 4 and its expansions. Although apparently we are also losing some titles for online service, and that includes Civ Rev. You're losing some of them. Some of them they will provide support for still.
The Civ Rev support that's being lost is specifically for the DS?
Ah, yes, of course.
It is mentioned, as of May 31st, Borderlands 1 and Civilization Revolution on the PS3, yes, they will go offline, but they are, quote, currently investigating the technical feasibility of transitioning those titles, unquote. Tie this to a comment that Mackie made on the last episode, so I'm jumping ahead actually to episode 197 feedback. Mackie, I think you'd made a comment about what EA game really relies on GameSpy, and PL Spirit 81 on our YouTube channel goes, Crysis uses GameSpy. And I'd responded to this person, and I said, following a short investigation on my part, it was a little more than 1 week ago, that the developer, Crytek, announced that after GameSpy's multiplayer service is shut down, the end of May, multiplayer service goes with it full stop.
Yeah, I was going to say Crysis is how many years ago now? Because that was just the first game in that series.
2007 for Windows, and then the Xbox 360 and PlayStation 3 version 3 years ago.
And it's had two other versions, at least, that I can think of off the top of my head, so I really don't think multiplayer for that disappearing is a big thing. Now all the Crysis players hate me.
Canuck Soldier on Civ Players, of course, we talked about on the last episode about the shutdown of GameSpy, and for Civilization 3 and Civilization 4, the efforts for the circumvention with the groups on Steam for Civ 3 and Civ 4 being coordinated through Civilization Players, which have ongoing multiplayer leaks for both of these games, as well as Civ 5, although to a lesser degree. He says that there are many unanswered questions from all of us with regards to legacy and non-Steam games, and apparently the moderators of the 2K forums are trying to find out the answers, such as, will legacy games be patched, or will we have to download Steam versions of the games, and if so, will they be free, at least for a limited period of time, and will Civ 3 and Civ 4 lose their built-in chat lobbies, and it's assumed so, like Civ 5 has with a just games list. So, still more questions to be answered, but I'm glad this information came out, although I wonder if in the PR department someone forgot to press the publish button after it was announced that GameSpy was shutting down. Because it was a little unnecessary upheaval, I think, in the Civ community to have this vacuum of information. And I called them on that in the last episode, and I'll call them again, and I promise not to bring it up in the future much.
Much.
Don't focus on this one word, Michael.
Bum, bum, bum.
You know, when I first heard the news, I had just been playing Civ 5 pretty well constantly, and I play a few Civ 4 games, but directly through P. I don't really go to the game lobby anymore, and when I first heard the news, it was like, meh. You know, a few years ago, I would have been devastated by this, but to me, it's a non-event. I don't know how many other people are in that same boat, but if you haven't been playing Civ 4 for a while, or Civ 3 for that matter, like, is there that many people that still play those games? I didn't think there were that many people active.
There's a decent amount, actually.
Yeah.
Civ 4 is a fairly strong community still, but...
Yeah, the modding community is still much better for Civ 4.
Oh, yeah, that's a fair point. Yeah, that's a fair point. My involvement with Canuck Soldier and is that I was one of the original founders of Civ Players, so I know him well. So they're in a position to help bring the multiplayers together, so hopefully it works out.
And I think speaking of bringing multiplayer together, I think at this point in time for a lot of people, once you find those who you want to play with, and then certainly in the case of myself and the others who are part of our cooperative Civ experience, or even people you want to play against competitively, it's been almost 5 years since the last Civ 4 expansion came out, let alone the last Civ 3 expansion, like a decade or more or so ago, that you know who it is that you want to play with at this point.
Yep.
And you have contact with them outside of that lobby, whether you're on Skype or TeamSpeak, email, private messages, but I don't think it's that particular big of an issue. And I know for myself, at the time was playing Civ 4. Now, I haven't played Civ 4 since the first Civ 5 expansion pack came out, but it was all direct IP games, in part because I had a dickens of a time with GameSpy, but in fairness, I don't know if that was so much GameSpy's fault as it was my router firewall not playing nicely with GameSpy, which was, so it kind of necessitated the use of direct IP.
Yeah, it's kind of a funky setup if you want to break through the firewall and still be able to play properly. I found a game on Steam, chat room group there called No Quitters that they are dedicated to...
Also, and I really haven't seen this picked up yet in the Civ community, kind of buried in one interview about Beyond Earth that I think is also worth mentioning. In the Time article, which was Sid Meier's Civilization Beyond Earth might be the Alpha Centauri sequel you've been waiting for, Dennis Shirk, again the lead producer on the Civilization franchise, says, quote, "And I think in Brave New World, when we finally closed out the series..." And I reread that, and what's been put in square brackets by the Time article writer, Matt Peckham, the final Civilization V expansion.
Mm.
And then later on, Pete Murray, the associate producer, is quoted as saying, "We're still building on where we were at the end of Civilization V."
So unofficially, officially, no more.
Yeah, and I'm like, whoa, 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 I kind of did a double take, and then I went on the forums, and I'm like, there's no conversation of this? So let all of the ranting and raving and celebrating or somewhere in between begin, because like Mackie said, it sounds like Civilization V, at least as far as expansions go, that's Civilization V expansion. Do we mean expansion lowercase or uppercase? Like,
and I'm sure we'll still have map packs.
Yeah, like with downloadable content, you consider that lowercase e expansion. And what about patches? Does that include patches? Like, is it really done? Because the Lost Beyond the Sword patch came out 2 or 3 years after the expansion itself came out. Something like that. So who knows?
I really hope there's a patch.
And, of course, the interviewer didn't pounce on that wording. Come on, Matt.
Can you read the exact wording again, Dan?
There's one from Shirk and there's one from Murray. The lesser one from Murray was, we're still building on where we are at the end of Civilization V, quote-unquote. But before that in the article, Shirk says, quote, and I think in Brave New World, when we finally closed out the series, unquote. And then Matt Peckham, the writer for the article, put in square brackets as if to clarify the final Civilization V expansion.
Okay, so they're not saying there's not going to be more Civilization. There'll be a Civilization 6, but...
Oh, yes, it's about Civilization 5, because I know on the last episode, some people were like, wait, Civ 5 is done? What's up with that garbage? And some people were like, they didn't talk about whether Civilization 5 was done or not. It's just that part of the Phyrexian team has been and is continuing to work on the next Civilization title, Beyond Earth. But it kind of seems like in here, no, we are getting closure or have gotten closure, and we didn't even realize we'd gotten closure till after the fact.
Yeah, I can't see them doing anything else with Civilization V at this point.
I'd be surprised.
There's going to be a lot. I mean, the next year or two is going to be concentrated on Beyond Earth and talk about Civ 6. But the reason I asked you to repeat it is whether or not they were implying that Civilization as a franchise was coming to an end. But
No. No way. Too many characters.
It's a good rumor to start.
With all of the information that has been thrown at us in the last couple of weeks and from multiple sources, and I think once people read one particular article and then they're like, there's nothing new here, there's nothing new here, or they go to Civ forums and get summaries of previews on Civ Fanatics, for example. On the news coverage, they've broken it up into essentially or at least implied and certainly in the discussion. There's no new information, but just so you know, this site also acknowledges Beyond Earth's upcoming existence. Upcoming release, I guess, is a more accurate reflection because it does actually exist. It's just not public yet and finished yet.
Anyway, that's all I got.
Let's see here. That's all you've got, therefore you're not the Shoshone. I
another great segue.
Best segue ever.
Dan, you should be Dan S. Dan Segue.
Yeah. There was a topic from, Mega Bears fan posted actually the strategy, which he's been posting for a bunch of different civs for Brave New World, and he got around to the Shoshone, who are actually one of my favorite civs, just because they're so versatile, going into some strategies, breaking down what their abilities are. It's a pretty good guide and offers a lot of versatility in the explanation.
Does help with the Shoshone that if you are fighting on a higher level and they come to you in your land, you have that extra bonus fighting in your own lands.
Right.
Ah, yes, the Pride of the Ancestors, a plus 15% combat bonus.
Mm-hmm.
It's very nice.
And by the way, it's important to note that Pride of the Ancestors is only, quote-unquote, only given to military land units.
Yeah. And it applies to all friendly territory rather than just Shoshone lands.
Mackie mentioned the Pathfinder. It's the scout replacement, the only civ that has a scout replacement. It's got the same strength as a warrior, but it costs a little more. Yeah, well, it's worth that additional cost.
I just spam Pathfinders.
Promotion, by the way, for people listening, not certain. Native Tongue, where you can choose the reward from an ancient ruins, but there's also a cooldown period of 2 ruins for each option. So if you choose, give me free culture, and then the next ruin, it will not also be culture. And that also does apply, by the way, if you have a Pathfinder and you move another unit into a ruin. The only reason I think you do that is because you know if you don't that someone else is going to take it. But that also counts towards the cooldown period. And then another additional perk of the Pathfinder, as pointed out by Megaverse Fan, is that if you choose the option to upgrade the unit, it goes to a composite bow instead of an archer. And yes, it retains its Native Tongue promotion and ignore terrain movement cost that's associated with the scout, as well as any recon promotions that it obtained while it was a Pathfinder. Wow.
Those are fun.
Mm-hmm.
Survivalism 1 and 2 on a comp bowman? Okay.
Speaking of uniques, to a lesser extent interesting, if for no other reason than the fact that it's later in the game, unless you're one of those advanced starts people, and you know what I think about you.
Do they exist?
That's kind of brutal, Dan.
I probably shamed them all from playing Civ at this point, so no.
And now the one person listening has left. Man, these guys are jerks.
We're talking about the Comanche Rider, the cavalry replacement, the same strength and movement speed as a cavalry, yet the full striker promotion, which is plus one movement, which is retained on upgrade. And if it wasn't retained on upgrade, I'd be kind of like, eh. But as Mega Bears fan points out, since it stacks with other promotions, like mobility and lightning warfare, then you can have Comanche tanks and modern armor, where the armor would have 8 total movement, which is pretty impressive, actually.
That's just mean.
You mean awesome?
Yeah.
What about playing as the Shoshone, now that we've gone through the uniques?
I'm always a fan of civs that don't have a specific, you need to go towards this victory condition. As much as I like Brazil, it's like, hey, do this victory condition. Do it. Seriously, do it. And you don't really get perks to other victory conditions. I like the Shoshone because they offer a lot of variety. This better start, because you can work better tiles, and that kind of just snowballs, again, as Mega Bears Fan said, into other things as you go further down.
Yeah, except Mega Bears Fan writes that this Civ is designed to get off to a head start, but since they lack long-term snowball-yielding bonuses, I disagree with that.
A good start is a long-term snowball.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I'm like, oh, Mega Bears Fan, what?
Yeah, I know.
At one point, though, he does say that they snowball, and then at another point, it's like, they don't really snowball, but I think they are one of the best snowball civs, because, again, if you have a great start, it just continues to go.
Yeah, not that this is necessarily the greatest analogy, because it talks about going downhill as you progress through the game, but still, if you're at the top of a hill, let's get a snowball and I've got to roll down the hill. If you're able to start higher on the hill, then it's going to be a bigger snowball as it goes down the hill, and that's the Shoshone. They're not at the top, they're very near the top, and a lot of other civs are a little farther down than that, or really farther down than that.
That's what I was saying before, playing as, again, I'll just pick on Brazil, but playing as Brazil, I mean, you pretty much have to go cultural because you don't have bonuses towards anything else. Going cultural and all of a sudden somebody starts trying to kill you, well, good luck.
Yeah, good luck with that.
No, seriously, my culture is great. Love me. The Shoshone, they don't have a specific bonus towards anything, but they have a pretty good bonus towards everything.
Yeah, especially when you're playing on a higher level and you don't know which way you're going to have to jump, they can roll with it better.
Yeah, we're just coming off of Easter here, so apt analogy, you know, eggs in baskets. Brazil has most of their eggs in one basket, whereas the Shoshone have
a lot of baskets.
A lot of comparable eggs in those baskets as well. If it's, I'm going to go and crush everything, and let's use that to take this land as mine and settle it, and use it for choke points to cut off this half of the continent because I'm over here and all the AI or the other humans are over here. But then you get a little later on, and perhaps the other AI are like, hey, we need to get rid of this Shoshone guy because he's being a land-grabbing SOB. Then it's like, okay, well, come at me. Come fight me in my territory. Let's see how well that goes.
Come at me, bro.
Exactly. Thank you, Mackie. I was hoping Mackie, if everybody was going to say that.
I was thinking it. You bring up the good point. You can cut people off. If you're on a little jut off of a continent, maybe with other civs, you'll need like 2 or 3 cities in order to block them off. But with a Shoshone, I mean, 1 or 2 might work. Freely settle whenever you want, whenever happiness allows. I mean, we've been talking a lot about the defensive aspect of the Shoshone, but I think they're great offensively because that extra land, I hate when the Shoshone are next to me because they may not settle in the spot that I want, but their land takes up the spots that I want. If you're playing as the Shoshone, I think that that's a good way to pretty much limit the AI in terms of expansion, or at least the tiles they can work.
The Star of Hope in the chat could always harass them from outside their territory, prevent them from sending settlers out if they won't bring the fight to you, and slowly they'll fall behind. I think that can work in part. I think the other part of that equation would be, what are you doing to get yourself ahead? Like, in other words, if you're preventing them from sending settlers out, if that means sending settlers outright, then depending upon the territory they already have and how well they've improved it and their technology level and their contacts with other civs, that might be something that you're going to have to wait too long to realize. But if you're able to, hey, as soon as you come out of that territory, I'm going to get you, and because you've gone ahead and done that, trying to get them to come out of their territory, if you're able to truly block them from that, particularly on the water, but also on land, and then settle more cities yourself, and improve those cities, and improve your diplomatic relations, tying to what we were saying, you know, with other civilizations, then yes, I could see that working too. And also back to taking tiles and the great expanse unique ability, as Mega Bears fan points out, free tiles that you get as the Shoshone, as compared to a standard Civ, I think it's like 3 or 4, do not increase the cost of purchasing additional tiles. And I hadn't thought of this direct comparison before. When he says, this means that you can buy unclaimed second and third ring tiles very cheap, It's like having a variation of America's Manifest Destiny as well, which, of course, America Manifest Destiny means that they can purchase tiles at a discount, which you can do as the Shoshone in a way because you've already gotten those that America could have gotten cheaply for free, and then by the very nature of that, your then next purchase, even though it's not discounted gold-wise, is actually a discount because you've got that much more territory still. If you're fighting the Shoshone, then you don't want to be fighting them in their land unless it happens to be naval units. Figure out where the Shoshone are, find one or more of their coastal cities, maybe it can even be their capital, and use naval ranged and melee units to bombard that city down and take it. Once you have one of their cities, and you're going to be quote-unquote in what was their territory, have them move out of their territory and into what is now your territory as they try to get the city back, and now they don't have that bonus anymore. Otherwise, countering the Shoshone, if you're not able to take land before the Shoshone, if you're not able to attack them on the water at all, or at least meaningfully to get yourself a city, then I guess you're going to have to push through the technology tree to make yourself that much stronger so that their ability to attack you when you're in their territory is negligible. More like a flesh wound rather than a death knell, a death blow. And if that means you have to wait a little while longer, then okay, just don't make it too long, and actually maybe something that you could do is try to provoke them into declaring war on you, like settling on their borders, and then the other AI in declaring war on them, even if it's just, okay, well, they agree to stop trading with the Shoshone, for example, and or they blockade their cities, just to try to slow them down, to try to slow that snowball effect we were talking about, so they don't get too big and too powerful.
The other thing, you could just Great General bomb your way into their territory.
Yep, you could Great Citadel your way in. Yes, that's true too.
That's what I always do with the Great Wall people, and I figure it would just apply the same way with the Shoshone, except for you're probably going to need a few more.
Yeah, which I think ties well with the technological advantage, because then it's like, oh, what if I use all these Great Citadels and I don't have the Great Generals anymore for the combat bonus? Well, if you have superior technology, that's not going to be so much of an issue. Mega Bear's fan assertion that he disagrees with those who think that the Shoshone is ideal for beginners to civilization because, quote, giving players the early game choices from ancient ruins can be overwhelming. I think that's a weak argument, to be honest. Most people are just going to pick whatever it is they see on the screen right away and not really think much about it.
I think it's more from a crutch perspective, if you want to be honest, because the Shoshone allow you to bypass a lot of difficulties you might otherwise have.
Free stuff is free stuff. Could walk up there and be like, I don't know what culture is, but culture sounds good, I'll take that. Overall, getting a rune in general is a good thing, and if you have a little bit more say in it, I think, again, to Dan's point, I don't know if that's the most valid argument, because, again, free stuff is free stuff.
Oh, and Mega Bears fan says that the Shoshone are encouraged to spam Pathfinders, which do not upgrade except through ruins, so the new player may get stuck with a whole army of Pathfinders that will quickly become worthless and expensive. I think that's a stronger argument, but still, I don't know if there's necessarily an ideal Civ for beginners, because there's no two Civ games that are going to be the same. I certainly think that the Shoshone are good for already Civ players looking to increase their difficulty. I don't know if I'd say ideal, that seems to be a pretty strong word, but it's preferable for Civ beginners. It might not be the first Civ I have people try, though. It might be one if they try another civilization and they get frustrated with it, then I say, okay, try the Shoshone. It's like in golf, and I do play golf, it's knowing that person. Like, do they already play sports? Do they play other strategy games? Do they play games at all? Okay, that's a little different approach, which might be, okay, let's play like a civilization that's quote-unquote not the Shoshone because of all of these potential overpowering snowballing effects. But at the same time, you're really going to be able to realize those snowballing effects if you know that it's a snowballing effect and are going to be able to take advantage of it. So I don't really think having a new player play the Shoshone from the beginning is really that bad of an idea. It's just, I think, a matter of knowing the player a little more, and are they just going to keep going back, kind of what Phil says. Is it just going to be a crux? Is it just going to be, well, now that I've played the Shoshone, I don't want to play anything else? Because when I find out, what do you mean the other civs can't choose the bonus from the ruins? What do you mean other civs don't have this inherent combat ability in all friendly territory?
I would say that they would probably be in my top suggestions for new Civ people, just because it covers up mistakes a little bit better.
The Star of Hope says, the Shoshone encourages good behaviors for new players. It tells you to go scout and find ruins, which seems to be something new players don't do enough of. I know I find that just an interesting point, because I remember something that Sid Meier said with regards to Civilization Revolution bringing Civ to the consoles, which was, we're trying to put more things on the map to get people to actually come outside of their cities and to actually explore the surrounding territory, like not to be afraid of, oh, if I go out and explore, then I'm going to find people that are going to try to squish me, so I want to try to be hidden for as long as possible. I think, actually, that is a reasonable argument towards having the Shoshone, because you want to encourage new players to, you need to know the lay of the land. That includes where civilizations are, where city-states are, where barbarians are, and the Pathfinder is more likely to be able to survive a longer period of time to be able to do that, if for no other reason than that.
I think the snowball effects of scouting, and again, not just with the Shoshone, but in general, is a more advantageous thing to push. And I think that's why it's good that Shoshone push the scouting. I agree with you, Dan.
And on that point, closing, and Michael was saying this earlier, this is the latest in the civilizations that Mega Bears Fan is looking at. He's looking at them in alphabetical order. There's just a couple of more to go. Syria, Brazil, Indonesia, Poland, Portugal, and Morocco. And you might be wondering, Dan, that wasn't in alphabetical order. That's true. That's the order in which we've discussed them from least recent to most recent.
I was saying it before the show started, but the Shoshone were actually my first legit deity win, and it was mostly because I was being a jerk and just kept forward settling and declaring war on anybody who would not let me do that. I was on my own continent, stationed between Isabella and, what's her name? That nasty one. Elizabeth. Just randomly denounces me, probably because I stole 3 of her settlers.
Totally random.
And because of the Shoshone's ability, he had like the entire continent this brown blob, and I somehow managed to get the Great Wall, which I still, it amazes me. And I just killed everything, and it was fun.
Comment today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net. In March, Firaxis Games loses to Valve Corporation in 2014 Developer Showdown.
Basically, at this point, if you go against Valve, you're not winning.
The interesting thing is, though, that Firaxis, in being the runner-up, this was Valve's third win, but BioWare had been the runner-up the previous 4 times.
Okay, see, there was this little thing called the ending of Mass Effect 3.
First round, Firaxis met against Nintendo, won with 57% of the vote. Firaxis defeated Volition by a healthy margin. It's not said in the summary article what that was, and I wasn't able to find it otherwise. In the third round, took out Lucas Pope, the creator of Papers, Please, getting 60% of the vote. I was surprised, given the competition, that Firaxis was able to advance that far.
And it's just occurring to me, a game I'd love to see is kind of like Civilization and Beyond Earth combination, where it would be like Alien Invasion, where you have a civilization and something from another planet lands on Earth, and the world has to cooperate to beat back the aliens from another
Isn't
planet.
Isn't that called XCOM?
Oh, is that what it's called? Okay.
No, actually, I think that's the setting of the game that the aliens on the planet that humans are going to and Beyond Earth are going to develop. Because the humans are the aliens invading their planet, and they have to work cooperatively to get rid of
them. That's true. That's true, yeah.
All right, everybody, thank you for watching. This has been Polycast episode 198. I have been a guest co-host, Michael. We have been joined by Dan.
We'll give you a show down onto interwebs.
The Mian team.
I'm trustworthy as always.
Warning you two.
Greetings. Farewell.
And Makalua.
Yeah.
Steven, would you be willing to come back?
Yes.
If you want to have me.
What about you, Michael?
I already said yes. I jumped ahead.
Oh, you jumped ahead. Your name is also Steven. Who knew?
It's not.
Record date April 26th, 2014. Civilization 4 and 5 sound clips copyright Take-Two Interactive. Firaxis Games Mega Panel 2014 clips courtesy GameSpot. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net. In May 2008, James Robertson became the 25th guest to appear on Polycast. After this first appearance on episode 45 in our second season, he returned three times more. Episode 62 and episode 79 in 2009 and episode 106 in 2010. Due to James's commitments, personal, professional, and other gaming interests, he had not been on the show since. Now, this is not unusual for any Polycast guest, just as there is the opportunity for just one more appearance in the future, but it is with profound sadness that we acknowledge that there will be no more turns or appearances for James. On the 17th of April, he died suddenly at his home. He was 52. In honor of James Anderson Robertson, here's an assortment of clips from the Polycast episodes he was a guest on that have never before been heard publicly. I always like those random events where it's all of your X of unit type are now promoted to whatever, and I don't have any of that unit type. That's always great.
I like it when you've discovered something like muskets and they tell you that all your axemen can be upgraded.
I think this is a vote implicitly for your top 10 list, Dan.
Because it's fine because you read the top 10 list and then we get to bitch about what's wrong with it.
Yeah, exactly.
Polycast episode 62. Now my day is complete.
Or well dang.
Well dang.
Once you get to environmentalism, it's not an option to go back to state property. You can't do that. All your cities will shrink drastically. You have to keep that environmentalism going. So it's just broken. I've never liked the corporations in Beyond the Sword. They just don't do it for me, apart from Sid Sushi.
Well, they come across kind of as a late-game replacement for religion after you've gone to free religion, but they're just not powerful enough to replace religion. They're too late to really have much of an impact.
Well, they give you something to do with all those excess resources if you have a huge empire.
But it sounds to me like you could have both Civ 4 and Civ 5 installed on your PC.
Oh, yeah.
Happily play both of them.
Definitely.
Experience them as completely different games.
Yes.
Let's say, Civ 5 is a companion piece to Civ 4, not a replacement for it.
And just said, well, not even going to look for it. And I just happened to be in the Apple Store, and my daughter happened to throw the thing in my face.
Mm. Did it hurt when she did that?
Yeah, she's 15. She's got a little bit of a punch.
Person who started the previous thread on culture flipping, Species 5618. If you were a Star Trek fan, you would have given yourself a different number than 5618. Species 8472 from Star Trek Voyager. I mean, what an opportunity for a cultural reference in a thread about culture. I just had to call you out on that.
I think Star Trek references are negative culture.
I think my nerd meter just went off onto extreme.
Well, at least James had an appropriate response.
And let's face it, I think Lost in Space, where the saboteur is on the ship, that made a lot of sense. What, you guys have never seen Lost in Space? Come on.
Yes, yes, I have.
I'm trying to drive all memory of that whole TV series out of my mind.
That was before my time.
Speaking of faux pas, I think the next subject here looks like something that might be a personal problem for Dan here.
Oh, hey now. You agreed we were going to bring that up. In terms of the negatives, there are some bugs. Charlemagne, leader of the Holy Roman Empire, this translated to an acronym that is stain.
That's awesome.
I don't think I want to know.
Goodbye from all Quick and Associates.
And non-associates as well.
And affiliated presenters.
try to disassociate yourself, but it's not going to work.
Maybe that's where that stain comes in.
Oh.
Below the belt.
You won't be able to listen to an episode quite the same as if you'd never guessed it, because you will realize when you hear the edited version of this how much is cut.
Yes, it's a completely different show from what you recorded. It's amazing.
James, your wit and wisdom will be missed by all those who were fortunate enough to have known you. On behalf of myself and the extended Polycast family, rest in peace.